Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. That was our little songbirds that I've been playing at the beginning of the show. It's kind of a new opening. I like to change things up a little bit. Sometimes we're going to be speaking with Glenn Steckling tonight, and I'm going to read a few little sections from his father's book called Alien Bases on the Moon. But let me bring Glenn on the show and say hello. Glenn, how are you this evening?
Good evening, Mark. A pleasure to be with you. I'm doing just fine.
Good. Let me read a little section from Alien Bases on the Moon here. I'd like to get you to comment. It says here, the authors of the British book Alternative 3 suggest that our lunar exploration program has continued, but under complete secrecy. I feel that they are correct, and I guess this is your father speaking here, and agree that we have been exploring the moon secretly with vehicles propelled by electromagnetism, not much different from those who come to visit us from other worlds, except in their size. Can you comment on that paragraph, Glenn?
Certainly. The program Alternative 3 actually was released in Great Britain as a documentary. But it caused such an immense public stirring, very much like Orson Welles with War of the Worlds, that it was quickly rescinded and then relegated to a sub-documentary or sub-fiction or something like that in order to sweep it underneath the table. But both the book and the documentary suggests that we have continued our space program after Apollo 17 and have conducted trips to the moon, constructions on the moon, and mining and various other activities. It also suggests that the labor for those facilities was taken involuntarily amongst the population of this planet. There was a particular time when there was a great brain drain, I believe that was during the late 60s, early 70s, in which a number of well-known scientists and their families totally disappeared. And so it suggests that for those who are in control of these facilities, that one-way tickets, not only for the people that are the technical advisors, but also for the laborers that are taken there in order to manifest these subterranean lunar developments and bases, is part of the program.
Do you think people were like slaves? They were literally kidnapped and taken to the moon to work, their whole families even? Or how did
the book suggest that yes, that this is part of the process? Obviously, you're not going to go one way and be part of these secret installations and then allowed to come back and be a threat as far as the exposure of this information. So it was a one-way ticket, and so I guess you could use the word basically modern slavery, which is, you know, still conducted and all over the planet in many different hemispheres. On a terrestrial basis here, we have real slavery, economic slavery, and what have you. So, but in their case, these people were taken involuntarily in order to facilitate these installations.
Well, that's huge news. Who do you think is building these structures on the moon? Is it ex-Nazis? Is it the United States? Is it some international organization like, I don't know, the Bilderberger Group or the Trilateral Commission or some Illuminati group that's behind all this? Do you have any
opinion? All the names that you've mentioned are only peripheral names. These are just names and not really secret organizations because everybody knows about them. These are basically names on the outside of skin of the onion, which basically is a look at one hand and you don't see what the other hand's doing. So whether, you know, there's always this great promotional debate and marketing debate in this particular field of extraterrestrial visitations that is run by some unscrupulous operators that are constantly suggesting either the Nazis did them, which is ludicrous, or, you know, many other factions that could be involved with this. None of them have, I mean, if you think logically and rationally, none of them have access to the type of resources that was required to run these type of programs. There are only a very few governments on this planet, even at this time, who have the resources and the technological know-how in order to do this type of activity. And they're the ones who are doing it.
Well, that kind of suggests that the United States must play some role, I would guess.
I would say a very major role, yes.
Hmm.
Because, you know, look at the moon, you know, if you look at the moon, as Dr. Carl Sagan said, it is a perfect platform for many different things. It's a perfect platform for extraterrestrial observation of this planet. It's a perfect platform for us to go to in order to initiate more scientific programs, because construction can be done in a much less gravitational field. The environment is more prone to be able to construct larger types of installations, larger type of space vehicles. And most of the extraterrestrial visitors are building their ships in space as well, using materials from the asteroid belt, and some of these ships can be as much as, you know, 30, 40 miles in length. And so, consequently, the moon is also within our realm of space abilities. We also believe that the person who controls either the satellite orbits around our planet or the moon has a fixed base of invulnerability in order to control policies and events on this world as well. So it's like putting your biggest battleship out there where nobody can touch it, and it has the ability to observe and to act without any consequences. We do shoot lasers at the moon. We do shoot electromagnetic pulse beams and microwave beams. Those come from fixed-based installations around the planet. In fact, if you look on a navigation chart here for any type of long-range flying, you'll see there are certain areas that are not only prohibited but restrictive due to these type of activities. So you do not fly through these zones when they are active. And so we do all kinds of experimentations. And at one time, we were even lunatic enough to even consider sending an atomic bomb to the moon, but that was shot down in the late 60s. The Demilitarization Pact, keeping any one nation's predominance in space or on the moon, was initiated. But, of course, as we well know, that once programs are initiated on either side, it never, ever goes away. What the public witnesses today, technologically wise and advancement, is all developments that have occurred, you know, 20, 25 years ago. There's a huge lag time between what is really developed and what we finally get access to. So we do have a great deal of technological know-how. It is somewhat limited in some extent. The moon is a major sphere of our influence, and it belongs to our planetary body as well. And but further than that into space, we are still infants in our thinking and our abilities.
Did you by chance see the launch of the Falcon Heavy a couple days ago? This is Elon Musk's operational rocket that I guess is the most powerful rocket in the world by a factor of two. And he says it has the ability to lift something like 64 metric tons into orbit. Did you get to see any of that?
Yeah, of course, we all watch. I mean, I grew up in the space age and the space race, and so my thoughts and many of my generation are still fondly remembering Mercury and Gemini and Apollo and all the good things that came from that. And so, although I have one observation that I have made, is that with over 5,000 pieces of orbital space junk around the planet Earth, much of it which is dangerous to the International Space Station, to our space flights, and our satellites, you know, putting another large piece of space junk up there to satiate one's ego, I don't particularly find very appealing. I think that there are much more beneficial ways of promoting what you do than, you know, to potentially cause more problems for somebody else. I mean, shift the monkey to somebody else's back is basically what happens there.
Are you referring to the Tesla car that he put
yes.
into orbit?
Yes. Exactly.
You know, it's really impressive.
Some people think that that's funny, you know, but the repercussions. Everything
Weird.
Has responsibilities and everything has repercussions. And you know, and to be only on one side of that equation and believe that you can just separate yourself from any potential responsibility or karma or whatever term you want to use, I think is highly irresponsible. And so, but, you know, it's not only that, the space program, but, you know, many things that we do here on this planet, and especially in this UFO field, there are so many ridiculous claims made and preposterous nonsense that gets circulated, and nobody demands any answers or any tangible proof, and people just run wild with their science fiction imaginations, and that does us a great disservice, and it keeps this field more convoluted and more frictional, and it will never get us to any reality of any decent answers if we continue along this process.
You know what it feels like to me, seeing that roadster up there in orbit? It doesn't even look real, but it's almost like a psyop. I feel like they're just playing with my mind or something. Did it strike you that way at all?
Well, I see it as nothing more than a very visible marketing ploy in order to attract investors and stockbrokers and to bolster, you know, the company's financial difficulties and what have you. And so, you know, you turn on the television and then you see innumerable types of these psychological advertisings in order to convince people to do things or to accept things and what have you. And so it's always wise to use our own brain and own intelligence and to search out some education and understanding so that we don't become suckers for any type of exploitation. And that encompasses whether it's politics or space or UFOs or anything else.
The one of the most impressive things about the Falcon Heavy is the booster rockets on each side, which separate from the main section. They head back to Earth and they land on this tripod structure. But if what your father has written in the book here is true, I mean, we're using stuff that's much more advanced than rockets, even though these rockets are now reusable and they can use them to land. The whole idea of going to Mars with this kind of technology, again, it feels like some kind of psyop or something.
Well, we need to look at this at many different angles. First of all, the deconstruction of NASA to a great extent is due to the lack of funding. And the lack of funding comes from the lack of will of Congress. And the lack of will of Congress comes from the electorate who do not see past the end of their nose. They don't realize that the push into space has developed scientific advancement. The satellites that view our hurricanes and typhoons and give us early warning and predict our weather every day this is just a tenth of a percent of all the benefits that we have reaped from the space program. So on one side, we need a little bit of a public space program because we need that boost. But on the other side of it is that the more you go in space, the more people that go in space, it's harder to keep quiet what goes on out there, as we have seen so much with the astronauts who have spoken about their sightings of extraterrestrial spacecraft and their experiences. And so that's why there's a huge push to go to robotics, because, of course, a machine does what you tell it to do and it doesn't do anything else. And so by dehumanizing the entire space program, we do a great disservice. And the risks, of course, are high. But for those who are willing to accept those risks, why should we deny them that opportunity? Not only that, the human brain is much more complex than a built machine. And the ability to tap into experience and judgment factors is what a machine is incapable of doing. And so we still hold the edge, the upper hand of our own abilities versus anything that we can construct. Remember, whatever we construct has to come from our own brains and minds, so it has to be conceptualized there. So it still comes from a greater source. And so we have that. So yes, the lifting power of the Falcon is beautiful, you know, compared to the Saturn. But of course, we haven't done anything on a on the public scale past the mid 70s. I mean, the space shuttle was, 35 years old. We have to hitch a ride with the Russians to get into space. And so, while we politicize everything about how nasty the Russians are, we actually work hand in hand with them, and we have already since the early space program. Their scientists and their programs as well, and they were much further advanced in space than we were. The first man in space, the first woman in space, the first spacewalk, and I believe that they also went to the moon earlier than we did too. So there are many different, apexes of push to go in into space and to learn about our planet and to understand the commonalities of creation, the principles of life, how the elements and biochemistry work. Because once you understand that and all this other science fiction hocus pocus that we perpetuate in this UFO field becomes irrelevant, because the science will tell you exactly how it works and your imagination doesn't mean anything in comparison to what natural principle is.
Do you think the Russians put a man on the moon?
They haven't advertised that fact, but remember, since they had such a huge advantage over us initially here, that I think that it wouldn't surprise me if they did. I know the Germans did test a multi-stage V-2 that supposedly hit the lunar surface, according to von Braun, which was spoke about in very hushed tones. So, but let's look at space as it is. We have the Chinese in space, we have India in space, we have, the U.S., the Japanese, the Russians in space. We're all putting up satellites, we're all sending up probes. And, for instance, I gave a talk here not too long ago, which a gentleman accuses that the Van Allen radiation belts prevent us from going in space, and nothing could be more wrong, more obtuse. The Van Allen radiation belts are nothing more than charged particles. The sun sends out charged particles on the solar wind. We're bombarded with it. We're surprised, surrounded by it. It even goes through the planet and out the other end. And so whoever perpetuates this type of thinking, is doing a huge disservice. I understand it's in order to promote confusion, which is basically a very motivating agenda in this field. But in reality, I mean, as I tell the people, you forgot that hundreds of space telescopes, or rather terrestrial telescopes around the world, tracked Apollo from takeoff launch all the way to the moon, high-powered lenses on Mount Palomar 200-inch can focus in on the landing zone, and you can see the residual of the LEM there. So, they all have become so conspiracy wild that they have failed to use a little bit of common thinking and rational thought Because when I explained to them that there was trace by telescopes and you could watch it go there, then one gentleman said, well, maybe it went there, but there was nobody in it. You know, the story always changes in order to support some kind of an opinion, and we all know the old saying about opinions.
You heard someone say this at a conference. Was it one of the other speakers?
No, it was actually, I was speaking, and that question was asked for me, and then about 2 weeks ago, I was on another show, and the same thing came, the same question came about, and we talked about it, but the end result, well, I just don't agree with that. And I said, well, why don't you agree with it? Well, what is it that you find, unrealistic, unscientific? And people just want to grasp sometimes on, you got the flat earthers, you got the hollow earthers, and people are just unwilling to, wake up, I think is the best term.
Well, one thing that's often brought up is there are no stars in any of the pictures on the moon. And one thing I would say, maybe it's because the surface of the moon is so bright, it's almost like daylight on Earth. You can't really see the stars up there at that time. Now, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, there are three observations. One, that's an incorrect statement, because if you go through the thousands of picture catalogs on microfiche, you can see stars. You also have a thin lunar atmosphere that, depending on your apogee or your altitude in relationship to the photograph, you're going to get a haze layer, atmospheric layer, between you and the stars as well. And I have just never seen that to be an instant. And all you have to do is dial up Hubble Telescope and take a look at the amazing pictures of the cosmos, and there are certainly plenty of star fields there. And in fact, some of the description by the astronauts of the amazing three-dimensionality of the star field that surrounds you. George Adamski talked about that already in 1955 when he went up in the spacecraft and went into orbit around the Earth. And so when you go far enough from the planet, then the planetary glow or light reflection becomes less and less. And like you said there with the moon, if you're looking at picture frames of a full moon, nothing is more washing out than that particular a phenomena. In fact, if you have a telescope, you do not want to look during a full moon because the light is blinding, in fact, and washes out everything to a great degree.
Hmm. So in a sense, probably the main reason we didn't see a lot of the stars in the Apollo pictures is because of that brightness effect. Would you
say
that's
true? That's one of the three possibilities. Also, it's also a fundamental of how the picture is taken. Most of the lunar shots are not pointed up into black space. They didn't go 252,000 miles and all that effort and all that risk to point it into space. Those cameras and everything were pointed to the surface of the moon. And along the pictures of the astronauts and standing on the surface and what have you. So you have a very low horizon in each and one of those 15x11 Hasselblad pictures. And like I said, I've got a whole stack of them in the safe. We got them originally from NASA in the 70s, first generation copies, so they were fooled with, and so no airbrushing and stuff like that. And So consequently, whoever makes that statement should be called upon to prove it. And that means you're going to have to go through thousands of pictures. And the moment you find one star, then the rest of that theory goes into the trash can where it belongs.
Yeah. The other thing that I think is strange or hard to understand, I guess, in some ways, if you look at, like, the LEM and the command module, the skins or the thickness, the metallic protection for the astronaut is very small. It's only like, what, a quarter of an inch or half an inch. And I think In the daylight, and correct me if I'm wrong, in the daylight on the moon, it's something like 250 degrees above Fahrenheit, but in the shadow, it's 250 degrees below. Is that approximately correct?
No, I have not heard those figures. Remember, the sun gives off radiation and not heat. Radiation waves or the solar wind has to interact with an atmosphere in order to begin to cause a warming process. And so as far as the extreme temperatures on both sides, they say, of course, when the sun apogee moves and the terminator slides past, then it's dark and it's very cold. And then, of course, when you're exposed to the sunlight and then there's the radiation intermixing, then it gets warmer. But the amount of radiation, of course, has always been an issue because we built spacecraft based upon monetary infusion versus functionality. So we have weight is an issue, payload's an issue, and the type of skin, aluminum skinning, and things like that. And so these things are not very productive when it comes to radiation blockage. And so most of the astronauts all suffered from leukemia. Many of them died from it because of the extra exposure to the solar radiation. And you got to remember that these gentlemen also, that they didn't just do one mission. Most of them were doing two or three or even more missions into space. The people who did Mercury went on to Gemini, went on to Apollo, and so on and so forth. So they were many times up there. You know, not any different than an airline pilot that is subjected to about 22% more radiation than the people on the ground, whether it's night or day. I should know. I am one of them.
I know. Let me shift gears just slightly. Do you remember the NASA tether incident?
The NASA tether? Well, not without a little bit more descriptions, meaning what, the spacewalk?
That's the one
with Ed White?
No, that's the one where they put up a what they called the tether behind one of the crafts, the Apollo crafts they put up, and it was about 11 miles long. It was some kind of experiment they were doing, and the tether broke, and then they had this long wire in space, some 11 miles long. I thought maybe you had done a little research on that. I wasn't sure or not, but I find that to be one of the most interesting little NASA. It's just really strange because this tether goes out in space, and then there's all these lights that appear all near this tether. I thought maybe you had a opinion
on
that.
Or, think about that. Everything is affected by highly charged or supercharged molecules. This comes not only from the planet's electromagnetic field, but also from the influences of the sun and the rest of the planets in the solar system. So you have a high state of magnetism, and you have a high state of charged particles. In fact, charged particles, which look like a firefly effect that both John Glenn and George Adamski described while they were in space. And so when you have something that's metallic and you're dragging it at 17, or it's orbiting at 17,000 miles per hour around the planet and intermix that with the electromagnetic field, I mean, it's not very difficult to understand that supercharged particles are going to adhere themselves to this particular tether or to the materials upon which it's constructed. So I wouldn't find that difficult at all. In fact, when you look at some of the NASA photographs and you see the astronaut walking in a spacesuit, he's surrounded by kind of a bluish halo. And that halo is nothing more than supercharged particles that have adhered to the surfaces of the materials, such as the spacesuit and the spaceship itself. And if you look back historically, some of the descriptions of landings of UFOs and some of the people that have come out who were wearing spacesuits or the individuals themselves, they seem to glow slightly due to this same phenomena. So there's a huge commonality in things that we tend to always mystify simply due to our ignorance.
Excuse me. Do you remember the cosmonauts? I guess it was one of the Russian craft that was up there in orbit, and the certain cosmonauts said they saw what appeared to them to almost look like these large angelic kind of beings. Does that ring a bell with you at all?
Well, I remember the cosmonauts. First of all, the Russians are a bit more open with their material, while we call them communists or whatever else, in some degrees their release of information and material is much more genuine and authentic in some regards.
Right.
So, and it tends to be much more, especially when it comes to space and space programs. You know, what they saw, well, that's something that they have to describe based upon their experiences. And, you know, by far they're not the only ones who have talked about activity in space. And in fact, like I mentioned before, I believe on your program and many others, in 89, my father and I was at an international conference in Europe. The wall had just come down, and several Soviet scientists or former Soviet scientists wanted to have a private talk. And my father, of course, acquiesced because he knew how to honor confidence and anonymity. And so we had a conversation, and through that conversation, one of the little blurbs was that a few weeks before, TASS had released an article of one of these space saucers landing out in the remoter areas of the Soviet Union, out in the steppes, decommissioned air base, in which they feel that they leave open for these craft to land. They have a much more open door policy, literally, to the people from space than we do. And so the craft land, and the people came out. They looked like human beings like you and I, as described so many mm-hmm. times for thousands of years all over this world's different cultures and civilizations. And they walked into town amongst the people. And so that same story released by TASS, which was their official news agency and very highly edited because of perceptions of governments and politics and whatever, that's what they released. By the time I got to Western European, these aliens were now 8 feet tall with multiple eyes, and by the time it got to the American press, it was 8 feet tall, multiple eyes, multiple arms and legs. And he says that's how this field works. It is demonized and made to look purposely ridiculous, to be ridiculed and to be washed off, you know, as nothing of any account. I remember when I was in Israel, there was a talk of one of these crafts there as well, and it was reported on the same page about 5 pages back in the little bottom left-hand corner, along with the sighting of a mermaid. So there's a psychological agenda and factor that is how this field is reported and how it is manipulated, and so we have to get a little bit past that.
The particular case I was talking about was July 1984, and it was the Soviet space station Salyut 7, and it was on day 155 of their mission. So, and you make a good point there. I mean, by the time it gets into our media or whatever, it could have been completely twisted, right?
Well, not only that, you know, it's there are so many different caveats. You know, did they see a ship? Were the people EVA'd? Were they inside the ship? Did they see them through windows? And mm-hmm. so on and so forth. So there are many different caveats that we don't know. So unlike programs like Ancient Aliens, where everybody speculates and says, well, it may be this and it might be that and could be this and might be this, when they really don't know anything other than subjecting the public to their opinions, you know, we have to go back to the original account and all the information that's involved, and it's best not to leap to conclusions. I mean, many people have, you know, talked about interaction with so-called angelic beings. And if you look in the cultures of the world over the last 50,000 years, you will find that description is very common. In fact, if you remember George Washington, he described being visited to by two angelic beings in his tent one night out there when they were during the Revolutionary War, and they described to him how the future will look if certain things are done this way or that way, and or it might come out differently, and to be aware of the consequences and so on and so forth. And so who knows where those people or beings came from. So we need to keep our eyes and ears open to see what makes sense or not. But I do know that I remember in a book, it was a combined book, I think I may have it somewhere in archives, in which the astronauts, the U.S. astronauts and the Soviet astronauts, talked about their perceptions after being in space for X amount of time. And they unifiedly described it as that they were filled with a sense of awe and wonder, not only looking at the planet below them and being exposed to something else besides the daily grind that we, most of us, are so saturated with. They found that their thoughts became more and more free of the confusion and mayhem that is perpetrated on the planet. And that's not only the fact that you're not watching it and partaking from it, but also that you are leaving the realm of this world, and that also reduces this type of thinking. So they found themselves much more open thinking and much more receptive and much more in amazement and wonderment of all that their particular missions were partaking with. I think that would be a nice experience for all of us.
Yeah, I think so too. Get a different perspective on things. Do you think the weightlessness can cause damage to the body and or the brain?
Well, yes. And this is one thing that, since we are still infantile in our process here, if you remember the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey, the space station revolved. And that revolution is not any different than a revolution of a planet. It helps to produce gravity. And that gravity, of course, is much more conducive to our health. So the zero-gravity environment, as we do in our current space travel situation, has been medically proven to cause atrophies of bone and muscle and things like that. That's why they are so diligent in their exercise programs and their health and fitness programs in order to try to counteract it. And so for any type of long-duration space travel, this type of method that we're using now is not feasible. And so, and the only reason, once again, we don't do it is because we don't want to shell out the cost. And I think that the only way we can have a real forward progressive space program is if we come to a unified, shall we say, council or condition where we take the five most prosperous economies of the world and put together our funds so that we will build the type of technology that meets the mission versus meeting the wallet. But then, of course, then we have to put aside our petty differences, because you can't slap your flag on it and say that it's yours or we're predominant versus the rest of them. It becomes a unified program, a unified mission. That's the real direction we need to take this, and unfortunately, I don't see that happening.
I've heard that it could take as much as 300 days to go to Mars. That seems like way too much time and weightlessness to me. What do you think?
Well, you know, absolutely, we have to be conscientious of the physical aspects of these things. And, you know, once again, we are looking based upon current propulsion technologies, and we have looked towards other things, towards harnessing the solar wind, towards hydrogen propulsion, and what have you. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the most efficient is electromagnetic, but that's something that you can't charge for, and it's something that is you just can't use in one aspect and not bring it into the other. So if you're going to use electromagnetic propulsion, then you have to recognize the fact that the energy that the planet gives off, the billions and trillions of electrowatts, can also power your cities, your cars, your utilities, and all this other stuff. And that's why we don't go there, because we're afraid that if we let the camel's head into the tent, the rest of the camel comes with it, and it becomes an entire change of our social, technological, managed progression on this planet. And so we are holding back on things and develop and staying within the realm of all the development because of economics. Mr. Musk has a beautiful dream of going into space, but he has a beautiful dream of making a lot of money doing it. So, you know, at a certain point in time, where does, you know, the tire meet the pavement?
So our government is still hiding this electromagnetic propulsion.
Well, I think it's not just us. It is others as well. We have to understand that while we fear a one-world government, you've had it already for a long time, and you're not even aware of it. The decisions that are made, geopolitically, for oil and for arms, and you know what areas of the world are aggravated to stimulate one markets, and so on and so forth. That is way below the level of these monkeys we see in Congress. And so, in a way, there are no. When you look to the economics of it alone, and this is not far-fetched, this is just the banking world already for hundreds of years. There are no borders. There's no ideologies. The banks dealt with the communists. The banks dealt with the Nazis. The banks dealt with the capitalists. They deal with anybody who makes some money, because money is the driving factor. And so, you know, so these decisions are made irregardless of the stupid flag waving that they do for the average person, hoping to keep them mollified within that spectrum and not going outside and asking too many questions.
Do you think that George Adamski's contacts have been mostly ignored?
Oh, I don't have to think. I know, absolutely. I know from personal experience of over half a century in this field. I can tell you that whenever I watch these programs where they talk about moon bases and things like that, I can show you exactly the page that they've copied the picture from, but they never, ever mention the book, ever. And and I know some of these people, some of these producers and things like that. And there is a concentrated effort that has anything with George's name on it to make it irrelevant. And there's many reasons behind that as well, because there's nobody in this field. There has never been anybody in this field that had the substance, the quality, the contacts, both extraterrestrial and within our government and military. He had them all. They recognized who he was. He had a White House access card. He briefed two presidents. So the entire story of George Adamski is probably only 20-25% known. But even that is too much for most of these people. And it's not so much the governments and the intelligence community. It's this UFO field, the personalities in the field who are fighting tenaciously for their particular point of view that wish desperately to ostracize George. But I can safely say that we have been around for since 1965 and involved with it prior to that, and gives me great pleasure to go out and remind the people of George's stuff. And we came across a picture in the archives here of negative, a mothership hanging over Palomar Mountain, surrounded by probably half a dozen registering discs, and recently printed that up. So I always going back in and looking through, and you know, I have other things to do too. I got to work and make a living and pay the bills like everybody else. But there's always been such a concrete foundation of his information, what he describes in space, what he describes as going on in this world. His last unpublished book is Space War Inevitable, truly amazing. And the last publication we put out, Behind the Flying Saucer Mystery 2, was a redoing of his last book, Flying Saucers Farewell. We put in 55 pages worth of reference and foundation and evidence, a whole new illustration section of correspondence with official people. So anybody who claims that George Adamski was, a hot dog salesman, they're wrong. He never sold a hot dog in his life. Anyone who claims he fabricated the picture, anybody who claims he fabricated the pictures, the labs have already discounted that already from the originals many, many times over. So he continues to be a craw in the throat of many in this UFO field who try to keep as much distance as they can, because when you start to look at it, it exposes them for the frauds they are.
Adamski described a human named Orthon, a humanoid with long blonde hair and tan skin. I guess Adamski had a face-to-face meeting at one point with this individual, correct?
Yes, many times. And in fact, some of the photos from the original contact have been enhanced. And you can see the scout ship between the hills during the contact, hovering there, and that's part of the photographs, about half a dozen that I'm putting out there to reignite the interest in George. And so he met this individual. Now you have to remember that these people do not have names like we have, and Orthon was not his name; it was a name that George gave to him. And he gave them all the names to the ones that he met, simply so that he can relate to them in the book, so the reader can have some kind of a foundation upon which to associate who they were talking to. We find that people without names is very difficult, but in their case, they often communicate telepathically, so the spoken word isn't as prevalent as it is amongst us. And so he met with this individual, about 5'7", and at that point he had kind of longish blonde hair, Mediterranean color skin, tan with blue eyes. And of course, others in this field have taken that, tried to run with it and say, oh, well, he met a German, or he met a Nazi, or he met a Nordic, or this all kinds of other garbage. And if you read any of the book, it blows their accusations right out of the water, so they didn't even read the first 10 pages before they were shooting their mouths off. And George described men and women of different color, height, hair color, skin, and eye color. These are people that he interacted with. And in fact, when my parents were engaged talking to NASA scientists in Goddard Space Flight Center and Colonel Freeman of the Pentagon, the questions were, how many human beings from other worlds are walking amongst us? So that alone should give people cause to think that if they walk amongst us and you don't recognize them, then they look like you and I. I remember one space fellow. He used to wear glasses. And I asked him, I said, well, you have perfect eyesight. Why are you wearing glasses? He says, because you people on this planet are so superficial. You expect somebody to be angelic based upon your interpretation of what angelic means. I put on a pair of clear glasses, and nobody in there will ever think that I'm a person that comes from someplace else, because we will judge our eyesight of what we see the effigy of that person to be. So, but yes, George had interaction with many of these people, and he did introduce some of them to government officials as well.
And there are still some here, correct?
Oh, absolutely. The numbers kind of flow and ebb depending upon circumstances here on this planet. You have to realize that these people are traveling cosmos. They are traveling millions of miles of space, exposed to millions of planets, millions of people and at different states of understanding and characteristics. And we are just another, small classroom in the infinite cosmos of the university, so to speak. And so while we consider ourselves very important, and we even go as far as to actually believe that we are the only manifestation in the cosmos, and there are no more humans anywhere else, it shows a vast ignorance of biochemistry and astrochemistry, because all the elements and compounds and molecules come from space. That's how the planets are seeded, and that's how the evolutionary process begins. And it starts here, not any different than the other side of the Milky Way or anywhere else. It's coming from the same principles of life that are based upon the infinite intelligence, or God, as we call it. And so they come, yes, and visit us, sometimes in greater numbers than others. Sometimes they'll spend a little bit of time amongst us to reacquaint themselves of how and where they once came from in understanding, and also to pass along a little bit of wisdom and help for us. But they are not coming here to solve our problems. Anyone who claims that they are going to come here in mass in order to make everything right hasn't the slightest clue of what they're talking about, because the only way you fix your problems is by fixing them yourself. If somebody fixes it for you, you will replicate those problems again, because you have not gone through the lesson required in order to understand what you have done correctly and incorrectly. And so while they may give some guidance, they're not coming here to pick up your trash for you. And really, when you think about it, what an immense disservice that thought is, to even project that they should come and take care of us, because we're too stupid to take care of ourselves, because we're not. We're not stupid at all. We just lack the desire, because we believe in living a life that says, my will be done. And so when you've got 8.5 billion people running around trying to do what they want, regardless of who else has to be the consequence or responsibility of it, then you have the mayhem that you have on planet Earth.
Was George part of a cultural exchange committee? I think in 1957 he had a letter that was signed by someone named R.E. Straith.
The R.E. Straith letter is actually dealt with in our book, Behind the Flying Saucer Mystery. If anybody wants it, they can get it from us, either from eBay or Amazon or ABE Books. I suggested it. It has a lot of information to it. R.E. Straith was part of the State Department, and he wrote George a letter, and the copy of that letter is in the book. And it discusses his acknowledgement for the service and the work that he's done. So the State Department, of course, the government tried to slap a lid on it, claiming Straith didn't exist, and neither did the Cultural Exchange Committee, but we have done our due diligence and research and come up with the article where, in the paper, it describes the Cultural Exchange Commission run by the State Department. And so you had individuals that were well-placed, that were proactive and supportive of the materials that George brought forward, and also the space program, because he was instrumental in trying to get the push for that. And so there were some acknowledgments, like, for instance, George delivered a sealed message from the space contacts to Pope John the 23rd, in which he received the papal golden medal for, which I have in my vault. And so there are little things here and there, but George wasn't after notoriety for himself. Oh, hell, if he wanted that, he could have had it 1,000-fold. He was after to do the work and to educate the people. And oftentimes he said, you don't need to use my name at all. Keep me out of it. Just make sure it's done correctly. And you don't see that anymore, because everybody wants to jump in front of a camera. Everybody wants to slap their name on something. I mean, it's like a peacock fest every time I see these documentaries or I watch these programs on television. It's more about promoting their image than it is about promoting anything else, because in reality they don't have anything to talk about. It's all might, maybe, could be, should be, would be. They have no clue.
Let me ask you a question here. I've never interviewed Richard Dolan, but I've seen him on various programs. Do you think that you and him could have a respectful conversation, or do you think it would just kind of devolve?
Well, I feel, I would hope that everybody can have a respectful conversation. I got a letter from a fellow in Canada who had our material who confronted Mr. Dolan. And, of course, Dolan tried to boo-hoo George, and then the guy said, well, by the way, do you know about George describing this in space and describing this on the moon? And he went down the litany, and then Dolan kind of backtracked on himself a little bit. You got to remember that most of these people are very image conscious, and they want to protect their little, fraternity, and that's basically what has turned out to be. It's a fraternity of them, you know, all of them, like dogs on a dog sled, marching behind each other. And as long as nobody rocks the boat, or makes any waves, then everybody gets to have their little, 5 minutes of fame. But then, you know, I even watched one of these particular people have the audacity, after he told these people a whole load of BS, to talk about the principle of karma. And I thought to myself, well, if you truly believe that principle, you yourself should be scared out of your mind, because what you should have to pay for what you just told these poor people and misled them should really bite you in the behind. And so everybody's playing this little game. You know, another gentleman that used to work for the government for 20 years, poo-hooing the whole UFO field, now is, you know, walking around saying, oh, well, I support it. Do you really believe that once you work for the government and the intelligence community, that you get to just change track and do whatever the heck you want and say whatever the heck you want? Come on, people. Once you work for them, you always work for them, and the agenda is always transparent.
Do you prefer not to say this person's name?
I don't think it's necessary. I think people are smart enough to go out there, and the people who listen to the show or are interested in this field will go out there and find and listen to any number of people, as they should, because this is a learning process for them. The only way that you can build a strong foundation upon which to build upon is by experience and exposure. And so you got to go and, you know, you got to go through the, pay your dues and go through the process in order to finally figure out what makes sense to you and what doesn't. But
there is so much, there's so much nonsense out there, man. I really don't feel motivated to say any names right now either at a particular moment, but it's the stories are just becoming more and more and more absurd. It's a sad state of affairs, for sure.
Well, you know why? Because most of it is driven by science fiction. And science fiction, I recall when the movie Stargate came out. Oh, it wasn't too long afterwards, the bandwagon people jumped on there and started to affiliate it to UFOs and all this other stuff. And this is what replicates itself over and over again in this field. The people cannot tell the difference because they're not being educated, and then on top of it, they're too lazy to educate themselves. So they are simply accepting the verbatim version of Star Wars and the bar scene and any one of these movies from outer space. I mean, think about it. How few of them actually leave you with some kind of decent message and some kind of fundamental thought process, as most of it is there just to scare the living daylights out of you and to subliminally suggest and implant in your brain this type of misinformation. And so people, of course, I mean, have you watched the movie Alien 1 through 3 or Predator and any of these things? Hell, no wonder people can't sleep and have nightmares for 3 days, because it has been visually imprinted into their brain, and it's done over and over again. I find that they do marathons. The other day I watched and channel surfed and said, I got about 5 or 6 of these movies playing on every channel for the entire evening. And I think to myself, well, who are they trying to influence? And for what reason are they trying to influence them right now? Because that's what it comes down to. And then in a great token, then you have a new generation that that doesn't know, that accepts everything off the Internet or off Google or Wikipedia or what have you. And And so they're inclined, like I mentioned before, like I told the guy about Apollo, that all the telescopes watched it from around the globe going to the moon. That man had no clue about that. Didn't even occur to him. And so consequently, how do you make definitive statements? They didn't go, or you cannot penetrate the Van Allen radiation belt. How do you make definitive statements about what you don't know and haven't got a clue, and you're simply repeating what somebody else says? And it doesn't occur to you that, is there a reason why I'm being telling all this nonsense? We have a lot of work to do.
Last question, and then I want you to tell everybody about your website and the new book and everything. Did George ever talk about a faked alien invasion?
He didn't talk about anything that's faked. No, he talked about the different forces that exist in this solar system and beyond. And so people need to understand that while some of our space visitors, in order to travel space successfully, you have to be about 3,000-4,000 years ahead of us, unbroken.
Mm-hmm.
And our civilizations go 300-400 years and crash, and we start all over again. And so the mm-hmm. successful long-range navigation between planets and between star systems is way beyond what we can even conceptualize. This means that from the society standpoint, you cannot progress in only one factor without the rest of it being dragged forward as well. We see that here on our own planet. It happens at different phases, but as we progress into a better state of living, we are also progressing sociologically, ethically, and what have you. We'd like to think so. In some respects, when we look at the world, we see the opposite happening. But in this case, there is that tandem rising of the graph, so to speak. So, but that does not mean that everybody who comes from space is benevolent totally to our cause. What it does mean, though, is they have one standard understanding. And while we are familiar with the fictional prime directive from Star Trek, where you don't interfere with other cultures, they also have a prime principle. And that means that you cannot do body or physically harm to someone else without incurring the principle of karma. And they don't want to pay that because they truly understand what it means. While we just fiddle around the edges, we really don't understand what karma means. And so they are not above engaging with us to see how clever we are. Think of it as a chess game. And they sit mm-hmm. down and play a chess game, and if they can convince you to do something stupid because you're unaware of what thought is your own or your own characteristics, or if you give us what we want, fame, fortune, power, influence, these become the bait. This becomes the hook in the mouth of people on this world in order to carry forth agendas that are not so benevolent. And so So we have to understand how this process truly works. We think that if somebody is going to come do us harm, they have to look like a gargoyle. Or in the reciprocal, if somebody's good-looking and coming from space, then that can't be true because everything in space has to be Spielberg, Star Wars. We have a huge amount of stuff to learn, and a lot of people in this field are not above exploiting these ignorances for their own benefits. It is truly a travesty.
AdamskiFoundation.com, what's new there?
Well, we have got a new page with photographic evidence and enhancements done by one of our friends in Denmark. And you will see the pictures in a much more clear scale from the original scannings. There are some inputs in there from other associates having to do with the validity of the photographs. There was once this big claim not too long ago that the that George's pictures were really the top of a Coleman lantern. The full analysis of a Coleman lantern is completely conducted on that page, and we'll show you that it's absolutely bull. Not only that,
that's all that page.
Yep, and then on top of that, when you looked at the scientific analysis of the pictures, the crafts were at least 33.5 feet diameter, and so that makes one hell of a Coleman lantern if you think about it. So that's new on there, and then the book, Behind the Flying Saucer Mystery 2, I think people will find it very informative. It deals with some of our experiences in this field. And a lot of stuff George talked about, and I am in the process of writing my own book now called Can Truth Prevail? Hoping to put that together here by the end of the year.
That's awesome. Are you going to have, well, I'll just wait. I don't want to throw any questions in about it.
Well, basically, it will be a history of my family's involvement in this field, the many different experiences we had, government with scientists in foreign countries, the different sightings and exposures and interactions, and then I will take a point to address some of the misconceptions in this field. I finally, after years of being ambassadorial, have decided to be much more straightforward, because I feel that when I look in this field, the plethora of garbage is never-ending being promoted, and so I think to myself, why in the world should I be hesitant to speak truth? And like George used to say, let the truth be told or let the heavens fall.
Glenn, thank you again. It's always fun. Have a great evening, sir.
Thank you so much. You have a good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.